Information at edgecenterarts.org. And we thank Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota Certified Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. Thank you to all of our veterans who are listening. We appreciate your service to our country. Forecast for today, mostly sunny, highs near 42, breezy northwest winds 5 to 15, gusting higher, partly cloudy overnight, lows in the upper 20s, and for tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the mid-40s, and breezy winds from the southeast. Northridge Community Credit Union in Virginia hosts holiday pet photos this Thursday from 4 to 6 with the Mesabi Humane Society. All proceeds benefit the animal shelter, and donations of pet supplies are also welcome. All pets must be leashed. An MS support group meets at the IM Hotel in Grand Rapids the second Thursday of each month. That's this coming Thursday from 11 to 12:30. We continue with Morning Edition.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. One of President-elect Trump's biggest policy priorities during his first term was trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. That did not happen. As NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports, it's unclear what Trump's next term will mean for the law, also known as Obamacare.
Former President Donald Trump did not talk about Obamacare very much during the campaign, except to say he had concepts of a plan for what to replace it with. It seems unlikely Republican lawmakers will go all in again on repeal and replace, but there still could be changes. Sabrina Corlett of Georgetown's Center on Health Insurance Reforms summarizes Republican leaders' priorities.
They want to lift some of the regulations that govern insurance companies, including some of the protections for people with pre-existing conditions. There is also interest in reducing the amount of federal spending.
That could mean cuts to Medicaid and federal money for subsidies to make plans on healthcare.gov more affordable. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
President-elect Trump says he is naming a former top immigration official from his last administration to become the White House border czar in his next administration. Writing on his site, Truth Social, Trump says he had tapped Tom Homan, the former acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Trump says he will oversee border issues as well as deportation of all people illegally in the U.S. Homan says he'll focus on workplace raids.
We have to secure the border. And as far as the people want to push back on deporting these people, what is the option? You have a right to claim asylum. You have a right to see a judge, and we make that happen. But at the end of that due process, if the judge says you must go home, then we have to take them home. And because if we're not, what the hell are we doing?
He spoke on Fox News. Wildfire crews will be back in the field on both U.S. coasts this morning, battling blazes in California, New York, and New Jersey. Over the weekend, one 18-year-old crew member was killed battling a fire in New York, as NPR's Brian Mann reports.
Daryl Vasquez was helping battle the Jennings Creek fire near the New York-New Jersey border when he was killed. That incident remains under investigation. Crews have been making progress, with New Jersey's Forest Fire Service reporting one blaze northwest of New York City 100% contained, but other wildfires are still burning out of control, sending a pall of smoke over parts of New York City and the Hudson Valley. With drought conditions causing extreme fire hazard, officials have tightened a burn ban to include campfires and outdoor grills. In California, meanwhile, crews are battling much bigger fires, including the Mountain Fire in Ventura County that's burned 20,000 acres and consumed more than 160 structures. Brian Mann, NPR News, New York.
The National Interagency Fire Center says there are at least 14 large wildfires currently burning in the U.S. They've scorched nearly 500,000 acres. This is NPR. The next World Climate Summit has opened in Azerbaijan. Countries are again talking about ways to reduce global warming. President-elect Donald Trump briefly pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accords. These are intended to help the world pull back from global warming. Japanese lawmakers voted to keep the nation's prime minister in place despite the drubbing his ruling coalition government took in elections last month. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports the prime minister will now lead a government with a minority in parliament.
No candidate won a majority of votes in the House of Representatives, so it came down to the first runoff vote in 30 years. The opposition could not unite around a single candidate either, so lawmakers voted for incumbent Shigeru Ishiba to stay on. Without a majority in parliament, he'll have to scrape together enough votes to get individual bills and policies through the legislature. Another challenge Ishiba faces is warding off tariffs that a second Trump administration could levy on Japanese exports. Ishiba is trying to arrange a meeting with the president-elect before or after a G20 summit in Brazil this month. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
The former artistic director of the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater has died, according to a spokesman for the company. Judith Jamison was 81 years old and died after a brief illness. She was formerly a principal dancer for the company after first performing in New York with the American Ballet Theater. Jamison became internationally famous in 1971 for a solo performance called Cry. The creator of the performance said it was, quote, dedicated to all black women everywhere, especially our mothers. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
At KAXE, we keep it local.
What kind of instruments should we expect at this percussion ensemble?
Starting from the stage right, we would have like timpani. There's a drum set involved in there.
I just miss people. Grandparents and the way things were. And you feel a lot of things this time of year, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in my family.
What was that like? Tell me about it.
It was very fun. I tried to make the lollipops as big as I can make.
Like as big as your head, or how big?
I'm Heidi Holton. We need your support to keep it local. Text the word donate right now to 218-326-1234, and thanks.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, what happens next to the wars in Ukraine and in the Middle East as the once and future president takes power here in Washington? First, we're following President-elect Trump as he begins to staff his administration. One of the first appointments was of Susie Wiles, the campaign manager, soon to be the first woman to serve as White House chief of staff. Big job. So how involved will women be in a second Trump administration? New York Times congressional correspondent Annie Carney covered Trump's first term, and she's on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so early in the first administration, you wrote about how men were constantly quitting or being fired. Anthony Scaramucci, Reince Priebus, all these guys, while some women seem to be survivors. Why would that be?
That's right. The women, the Kellyanne Conways, the Sarah Sanders, the Hope Hicks, Ivanka, these people stayed the whole time or left on their own terms. And I think the top line reason is that Trump didn't see them as direct competition in the same way he might have seen, not like in the caricature of Steve Bannon pulling the strings from behind the scenes and him just being Steve Bannon's puppet. That was never how any of these women positioned themselves when they worked in the White House. And that kind of level of direct competition is not something that serves someone well working for Trump.
I don't want to psychoanalyze here too much, but, you know, if you're a guy trying to be a strong, manly man, does a man just automatically seem like more of a threat to you?
I mean, possibly, yes. And these women who survive there kind of play along with him. There's no evidence that they challenged him or wanted to be seen as kind of the main player. They were oftentimes obsequious to him. Like, I remember at the inaugural ball when he called out Kellyanne Conway, she smiled and curtsied. Ivanka famously laughed along when Trump back in the day said if she wasn't his daughter, he'd want to date her. They are willing to play the role that he wants them to be in, and that allows them to survive and actually have great power in his circle. He's also someone who, like, way back to his real estate days, has actually considered himself a professional promoter of women. there was Barbara Rez was a senior person at the Trump organization in his real estate world, who at the time it was really rare to have a woman at that level. And his father, Fred Trump, vehemently disagreed with his decision to promote her. So he has long like thought of himself as kind of an equal opportunity promoter.
Well, this is very interesting. Should this then complicate the idea of Trump and women that is discussed among Democrats, of course?
Well, the women who are loyal to Trump absolutely think so. They like to point to their own experiences with him, saying, you know, Kellyanne Conway says, I rose farther in Trump world than I did in a career in Republican politics. Ivanka Trump says, he treated me exactly the same as he treated my brothers. And they always point to their own experiences with him, which is not, that's fine, but it doesn't mean that hasn't been found liable for sexual abuse. It doesn't mean he doesn't regularly make sexist attacks. It doesn't mean that his policies are good for women. Like, they lean on just their personal experiences to defend him, which is a very weak argument for defending someone's record on women. And the bottom line is that both things can be true. He can be liable for sexual abuse and have treated a few women in his circle with respect.
Where does Nikki Haley fit into all of this? She endured the first administration, then ran against him, and has been told she will be out of this administration.
Yeah, I think she's a great example. She's someone who endured the first administration. She left on her own terms. She left, he gave her an Oval Office press conference where they sat side by side in chairs and he praised her. She called Jared Kushner a genius, I remember, in that press conference, and left like a star. Then she challenges him and he has said, there will be no place for Nikki Haley in my administration. She offered herself as a surrogate on the campaign trail and he never wanted that, even though people around him were concerned that he's not doing enough to reach out to women. There's no place for women in his circle if they go against him. I mean, that might be true for men and women alike, but she's out. She is no longer considered loyal. And we hear there's news this morning that he has appointed, or he wants to appoint, Elise Stefanik, the House representative from New York, who's been a loyal Trump defender, to be UN ambassador.
Oh, interesting, which is Haley's position. We should note NPR has not independently confirmed that, but CNN is reporting that. Let me ask before we go about Susie Wiles, the new chief of staff. What do you make of that appointment?
This is a little different. First of all, this is the first time a woman in his West Wing has the top job. And she's someone who actually is seen as the obvious person to take this job. It's only a benefit to him that she's a woman. That will help look like he's promoting women. But this is just someone who I think detractors and supporters alike thinks is the right person for this job.
A professional who's been able to deal with them. Annie Carney of the New York Times, thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you.
Take care.
President-elect Donald Trump reportedly told Russia's Vladimir Putin not to escalate the war in Ukraine. The Washington Post says Trump used a phone call last week to remind Putin of America's sizable military presence in Europe. NPR has not been able to independently verify that call, but Trump did campaign as a peace candidate, promising to end the wars in Ukraine and Gaza. We called up a former U.S. ambassador to NATO and former special envoy to Ukraine, Kurt Volker, to talk about the possibility. I want to start with that promise about Ukraine. This is something that the Democrats have invested heavily in, seeing this as an existential threat to the world order. Trump has said he would end the war quickly. I just want to play a little bit of what he said speaking at a town hall in May.
So I meet with Putin. I meet with Zelensky. They both have weaknesses and they both have strengths. And within 24 hours, that war will be settled. It'll be over.
Is that possible?
Since saying that in the campaign trail, he also met with President Zelensky in September in New York. He said there needs to be peace and it needs to be a fair peace, which is a good comment, recognizing that, you know, Russia's the aggressor here. And then he has repeatedly said that this would never have happened if he was president, which is a way of portraying Biden as weak and that he would be strong. So I think what he would do is want to reestablish a position of strength to tell Putin to end the war. And if Putin doesn't do that, then it's going to get worse for Putin. And it may be good timing as well. Russia is in a much weaker position than they let on publicly. Inflation is very high, interest rates are very high, and the military effort is in weak shape. As we saw earlier this year, they can't both attack Ukraine and defend Russian territory at the same time.
So the Ukrainians don't want annexation of their land, right? And the Russians don't want to give that land up.
Right.
And Biden has sanctioned them, put pressures in all kinds of different ways. What would be different about Trump that would get these leaders to the negotiating table?
Yeah, getting Zelensky to a negotiating table is not an issue. They don't want this war. This has only been about Russian attacks on Ukraine. The challenge is to get Putin to agree to end the war.
Hmm. Do you think Putin has a different view of Trump than he does of Biden? I mean, I just think about the way that Trump has professed in the past his admiration for Putin.
As I see, he doesn't want to demonize the people he has to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to keep open that space that he can cut a deal while putting in place policies that try to shape the playing field. And there were some very tough policies on Russia in his first term. I think because of that, Putin plays along with that and doesn't demonize Trump, says nice things about Trump. But if you look at some of the other things that the Russians say or do, they also are duplicitous and they'll say one thing and do another.
Now, Trump has also promised to end the war in Israel, Gaza, Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And I want to get a sense from you of what Trump might do that is different, sure, than what we've seen over the past year from Biden.
The main difference is to hold Iran directly accountable for the actions of its proxies.
Mm-hmm. Hezbollah, Hamas, Houthis, the Yemeni, Lebanese, Palestinian groups that it backs and funds.
Yes, yes. But we have messaged to Iran consistently now. We need to de-escalate. We need to avoid escalation. Well, this is read by Iran as a green light. That means they don't have anything to worry about. And so they can continue to feed their proxies, to threaten attacks on Israel, to threaten attacks on international shipping. And they do. So Iran is completely undeterred. This, in turn, gives a signal to Israel, you can't count on the United States.
But I will ask, though, Ambassador, I mean, at every turn this administration has provided the weaponry and the support for this war. So I'm actually kind of confused about the support.
It's very similar to Ukraine.
Yeah.
We provide all of this military support. We provide the ammunition, bombs, etc. And we tell them, don't do this, don't do that. That has been a, particularly in the Middle East, that approach has been escalatory by accident.
What would the direct responsibility that a Trump administration might put to Iran?
I think it would be the threat of strikes on Iranian assets from the Indian Ocean. And I would think we would look at their nuclear facilities and we would look at their oil refining and energy sector facilities, which is where they get the revenue from.
And so for both Russia and Iran, it sounds like what you're saying is that these countries would see this administration as an administration that would carry out on a threat of something like a direct attack.
Yes, and that is the whole point of deterrence. I don't think, you know, going back to your very first point, President Trump always talks about peace. He wants to reestablish peace. But you have to get, as he says, and he's quoting Reagan, peace through strength. And that peace through strength occurs when you're willing to do something and your adversaries believe it.
Ambassador Kurt Volker, thank you for joining us, for your insights and for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
morning. It's 8:19. You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock, David John, your volunteer host for On the River. Programming is supported in part by the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, serving Minnesota veterans and their families. MDVA wants to remind Minnesotans that November is National Veterans and Military Families Month. Be sure to thank a veteran for their service commitment and the sacrifices they've made to protect our country. Programming is also supported by Grand Dental Center, where doctors Lisa Johnson, Leanna McBride, and their staff provide full-service family dental care for patients of all ages in Grand Rapids and surrounding communities. More at granddentalcenter.com. Mostly sunny today, highs in the low to mid-40s, breezy northwest winds. We thank the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast for their support, a four-season B&B on Pekegama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities needed for a complete family vacation. More at greenheronbnb.com. Loving the lake quietly. We also thank the Pickett Agency, an official MNSURE partner. It's open enrollment season, and Pickett Agency is here to support the Bemidji community with health plan enrollment and guidance. More information available by calling 218-751-1213 or at picketagency.com. Range of Voices Choir presents Fireside Stories this Friday, November 15th, 7 o'clock at Chisholm Baptist Church, and Sunday, 2 p.m. at Gethsemane Lutheran Church in Virginia.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the FDA. Its Remove the Risk campaign encourages people to dispose of the unused and unwanted opioid medications in their homes. Learn more at fda.gov/removetherisk. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Mexican drug cartel leader Juan Manita del Monte rules with fear and death early on in the new film Emilia Perez. But Manita wants to leave that life of violence behind and become her true self as a woman. Emilia Perez emerges from gender-affirming surgery, performing good deeds to right the wrongs from her past. French renegade filmmaker Jacques Odiar made the story into the world's first transgender Mexican cartel musical, and it's out in theaters now. I asked Spanish actress Carla Sofía Gascón what drew her to the title role. She spoke through her interpreter, Lorna Silva.
It's something that I've been reflecting upon after all this time, and it's to be able to dive deep into the darkness of this character. And there was the aspect of transition, but then my personal life has nothing to do with Emilia's transformation in and of itself. Now, there is another personal connection that I had to this role, and it's having a hard time accepting the loss of a loved one. And had I gotten this role about 20 years ago, I don't think that would have been able to give it the same depth than I'm giving it now at 52.
Now, you play Emilia Perez both after she transitions and before, when she's known as a brutal drug lord, Juan Manita del Monte. Which role was the darkest for you to play?
A ver, realmente es mucho más oscuro Manitas, o sea, la parte de Emilia cuando es Manitas.
Well, you know, Emilia as Manitas is definitely darker because this character was trying to survive and could not be herself in the world that she had to live in. So she had to pretend in order to survive. And that is something that we humans often do. We try to please others, but we are not living our own life. We're not living for ourselves. In my case, I had to choose to live my own life. And in order to do that, I had to get out of the darkness. When I had to make that choice, it was very hard. And it was at a point, you know, I thought that somebody was going to support me with that choice, but They did not, and that's what often happens, where we end up in this very difficult, tough spot and with no one around to support. I ended up in this deep hole, lost, and even wanting to leave this earth. But, you know, having this chance to be able to see the light at the end and to be able to climb out.
Now, I understand when the director suggested that a cis male actor could play the early pre-transition scenes, you insisted to play the role of brutal cartel leader Juan Manitas del Monte. So how did that decision come about?
Porque soy una actriz que quiere hacer su trabajo lo mejor posible.
Well, I did because I'm an actress and I want to do the best possible job. And this just simply would not have been the same if you had had two different actors, an actor and an actress, a trans actor with a cis actress or a cis actor. This was an opportunity, and I pushed for it because this is something that had never been done, that had never been dealt this way, and this was perfectly constructed. You know, a gentleman in Mexico suggested to me, well, maybe you should also be nominated as a best actor, best male actor. And I said, like, you know, please excuse me, but what if I was nominated for as a vampire? Would I be nominated for a best monster? No, I'm an actress, so I get to be nominated for actress, for who I am.
So take me through that process of deciding that it was going to be you for both roles.
¿Cómo fue el proceso para llegar a los dos roles? Pues...
Well, the first thing that I did, which is funny, I sent videos of myself. And I love dubbing, so I did the video with a deeper range than my own. And I used Snapchat filters that, you know, put beards. When I explained it to them, they laughed so hard. And I realized that they believed in me. For the first time that they believed in me, they thought that I could do it. It was on a trip to Paris when they took a mold of my face and tried a different prosthesis because they wanted the characters to not look alike at all from beginning to end. He wanted a huge transformation that would have a big impact in the audience. Think of it like Beauty and the Beast.
In the film, the Israeli surgeon who performs the surgery warns Manita's lawyer, Rita, that a wolf will always remain a wolf. Is Emilia Perez's moral redemption from Manita's a real redemption?
Yo siempre me imaginé a mi personaje como alguien que solamente fingía que era muy malo.
The way I saw my character... It was somebody who was pretending to be bad, who was having others, you know, do these bad things, but it wasn't truly what he was doing. So that's how I was able to see it, so that then Emilia could have the big redemption. Now, as a person, we cannot redeem, fix, or undo our past sins. But what we can do is we can do things better. That's the real message of the movie, is we cannot fix those past mistakes, but what we can do is do the right thing.
At the Cannes Film Festival, the female cast received a collective Best Actress Award, and that made you the first openly trans actor to receive a major award at the festival. How do you hope this film maybe might change perceptions of trans people?
Yo lo único que quiero es aportar un granito de arena.
I would like to see this as a grain of sand, to help marginalized communities to become less marginalized, to be able to be part of society, regardless of your sexuality, your skin color. This is a film that will be seen by millions of people. So I think that we also have a social responsibility that goes beyond entertainment. And I find it both shameful and beautiful that in 2024, me, Carla Sofía Gascón, you know, after centuries of humans in existence, you know, that after all these years, that on the one hand, it's ridiculous that I'm the first, but at the same time, wonderful that I am the first, because I think that I'm somebody that has the strength to carry on this message.
That is actress Carla Sofía Gascón. She plays a title role in the new film, Emilia Perez. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for all your questions.
This is NPR News.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with a special edition of the Up North Report. World War I, known at the time as the Great War, officially ended when the Treaty of Versailles was signed on June 28, 1919. However, fighting ceased 7 months earlier when an armistice between the Allied nations and Germany went into effect on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. For that reason, November 11, 1918 is generally regarded as the end of the war to end all wars. Veterans Day continues to be observed on November 11th, regardless of which day of the week on which it falls. In honor of the patriotic holiday, we bring you this rebroadcast of a conversation I had about an effort to clean headstones in Hibbing and the memory of a World War I soldier whose legacy won't be forgotten. In Hibbing's Maple Hill Cemetery, the headstones of hundreds and hundreds of veterans will be painstakingly cleaned by volunteers with soft brushes and clean cloths.
Mainly, you just have to really be careful that they're like natural head hair bristles on your brushes, whether, you know, they have special toothbrushes and, you know, bigger scrub brushes, but they've got to have very specific types of bristles on them so that you don't damage the headstones.
Chris Magnuson leads the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon Committee for Hibbing and Chisholm. Minnesota's Beyond the Yellow Ribbon program started to connect community resources with service members and military families as part of the Minnesota National Guard. The Yellow Ribbon is a military tradition that symbolizes support for the troops. Magnuson and other volunteers, along with members of the National Guard's 1st Squadron 94th Cavalry, recently spent time in Maple Hill before Memorial Day. They learned the proper techniques for cleaning headstones based on national cemetery guidelines. She says Beyond the Yellow Ribbon took on the project under the initial suggestion and guidance of Perpetual Care of Minnesota, a Hibbing company that offers services to keep graves well attended. Magnuson is a Marine Corps veteran herself, and she says ensuring those who gave their lives in service of the country aren't lost to history is an ongoing effort. This summer's volunteer headstone cleaning project is another way to give back.
Oh, it's so much a part of our history and, you know, our country's history and our community history. You know, they just gave so much. You know, they paid the ultimate price to ensure that we have the freedoms we have today.
Perpetual Care also recently led efforts to replace a headstone in the cemetery in honor of a World War I soldier killed in action at the age of 22. Corporal Norman Kenneth Box's grave was marked with a simple and neglected footstone they accidentally stumbled upon.
It was covered up, it was dirty, it was scratched up, and they had immediately recognized, they're both World War history buffs, so they were familiar with the date that he died and the unit he belonged to. So they just got interested and started digging more to find out more about his history and his ties to the region here.
They learned that Norman was born in Ontario, Canada, and his family emigrated to the United States between 1895 and 1900. By 1905, when he was 10 years old, they lived in St. Louis County, according to census records. He married Alphazine Gosselin on April 23, 1918, and shipped out to France by June. He served in the 359th Infantry Regiment, and on November 6th, Norman Box was killed in action, one day shy of his 23rd birthday. The armistice was signed 5 days later, ending the war. His wife remarried, and upon her own death, was laid to rest by Norman's side. Perpetual Care was able to acquire a government-furnished veteran headstone for Norman, who was one of 40 soldiers buried in Maple Hill who were killed in action. And Magnuson and others organized a recent Honor Guard ceremony to commemorate his service, which was attended by descendants of his widow, with whom Norman was never able to have children of his own. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
For NPR comes from this station, and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, With an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. And from Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. When President-elect Trump declared victory, he vowed to govern by a simple motto.
Promises made, promises kept. We're going to keep our promises.
Each day this week on Morning Edition, we'll examine his promises. We start today with his vow to pardon hundreds of people who were convicted after attacking the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Legal scholar Kim Whaley is author of the book Pardon Power. She joined me to dig deeper into the presidential powers granted by the American Constitution and a recent decision from the Supreme Court.
The Constitution in Article 2 just says that the president has the power to grant reprieves and pardons. And it puts no express limits on a pardon. And although there's been some Supreme Court case law putting some constraints on the pardon, there is no law that would limit Donald Trump's ability to pardon the people who participated in the January 6th insurrection and ended up embroiled in the criminal justice system.
So another thing that Trump promised was to fire the special prosecutor investigating him, Jack Smith, right away. And the investigations are being wound down now, as we understand it, from the Department of Justice. But the Supreme Court decision that anything he does as president would be subject to presidential immunity, what does that mean?
So I think what it means is that Donald Trump could direct his attorney general to abuse the massive power of the Department of Justice and law enforcement. So that's number one. The second is the pardon. Of course, the Supreme Court held that if the president uses his official power, law enforcement, surveillance power, investigative power, prosecutorial power, that kind of power cannot be subject to the rule of law. But the immunity ruling only applies to the president. It doesn't apply to people around the president. So he would have to get them to commit crimes on his behalf. And the way to do that would be to promise a pardon and then actually pardon them. So the pardon, when you add that with this immunity for the president's illegal acts, so long as he uses his official power, it's sort of a recipe for, you know, a massive criminal enterprise in the White House.
And he has said on the campaign trail that he would go after his political and personal opponents.
That is what he said for quite a while. And, law is all about incentives and disincentives. And we have laws in place to disincentivize behavior we don't like. We have stop signs to disincentivize driving in a way that's dangerous. But people will blow through those limits if there's no consequence. And right now, what the Supreme Court has done by injecting immunity into a constitution that does not have it is to changed the incentives for presidents to basically lift any threat of consequences for abusing the massive power of the office. And of course, the framers of the Constitution understood, as Madison said, if men were angels, we would not need government. Mm-hmm. The rules are now lifted. And this is a president who has promised with vitriol to prosecute and go after people who he believes have, you know, prosecuted him in unfair ways. So I think we can take him at his word, or at least we should be prepared for that.
Kim Whaley wrote the book Pardon Power, How the Pardon System Works and Why. Thank you so much for your time, Kim.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, a closer look at Trump's promise to deport massive numbers of undocumented immigrants on day one. Listen live on the NPR app or your local station.
On this Veterans Day, let's go to Scranton, Pennsylvania for a visit with a 99-year-old recipient of the Purple Heart. This Army vet is best known in his hometown for his music, so Sarah Hofius Hall of member station WVIA found him on the bandstand.
Gene Passarella taps his foot and signals for the orchestra to begin.
One, two, three, four.
The trombones and trumpets blare. As Passarella conducts the band he has led since the 1950s. As the orchestra plays Moondance at Scranton's Italian Festival, members of the audience dance on the street. For more than an hour, the musicians play the notes Passarella has arranged over the last 7 decades.
It's like a certain pride. You write something and you hear it played back. It sounds nice, you know? And I love music. There's no question about it.
Passarella grew up in Scranton, the second youngest of 12 children born to Italian immigrants. The family loved music. He learned how to play the clarinet and saxophone. He graduated from high school in the midst of World War II, drafted to fight on the Western Front.
I did what every other 18-year-old did and was proud to do it.
He landed on the beaches in Normandy, France, 3 days after the initial wave of Allied forces in June 1944. As he crossed a snow-covered field in Belgium later that year, a sniper's bullet pierced his right leg. Passarella returned to Scranton and found a job with the U.S. Postal Service and love down the street. His wife Louise grew up a few houses away from the Passarellas.
I thought he was very cute. Yes, he's cute, I would say to myself.
Shortly after the couple wed in 1952, he took over the band he had formed with his brothers. He built a family and a following for the Gene Dempsey Orchestra, named in part by his brother. The Purple Heart that he earned in Europe and other medals hang on the wall in his home. The wedding cake topper the couple used 72 years ago sits in a cabinet nearby. He gushes about his bride, now 93.
That's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I mean it sincerely. I want everybody to know about it. Without her, I'd be nothing. I'd be under the bridge.
You're supposed to be talking about music, not about us.
Oh, what's that?
Passarella turned 99 this year, and the crowd sang to him at the Italian festival. Tim Van Noort, one of the couple's grandsons, sang along.
Happy birthday, dear Gene.
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, I've been watching him my whole life do this. I used to sit up on stage when I was a little kid. And now I have to help him get up on the stage, but no, it's great. I'm thrilled that he can still do it.
Gene Passarella's walker sits on the stage. He can't shake his hips, which his wife says the crowd used to love. His right leg, the one wounded in the war, bothers him now. But the music continues.
You know, I never thought he'd get this old. I'm looking to make 100 now.
He ended the concert with a theme from the movie Rocky. A song long associated with passion, motivation, and inspiration. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Hofius Hall in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:42. You're listening to Morning Edition on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 9 o'clock, David John, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. At noon, the World Cafe, and at 2 o'clock, we have some Veterans Day specials for you. We receive support from the Veteran Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of first call for help 211 and provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to veterans and veteran service member families who are in crisis. Trained veteran providers are available to serve fellow veterans 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. And support comes from the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation, playing a vital role in connecting charitable intentions with community needs, awarding $30 million in grants and scholarships over the past 30 years to make a lasting impact in our area. More at gracf.org. Weather today, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 40s, breezy northwest winds. And tonight, partly cloudy with lows in the upper 20s. And for Tuesday, partly sunny, highs in the mid 40s and winds from the southeast 10 to 15. We receive support from the Lake Superior Steelhead Association with a mission to protect and improve the cold water fishery of the Lake Superior region, bringing anglers together for the common good. More at steelheaders.org. The Nielsen Spearhead Center near Bemidji offers a walk on the wild side with a focus on nature journaling this Saturday from 10 to noon. Bring your own notebook and pens or supplies will be offered to you. And it is deer season in Minnesota, and this year we are hunting for new members to support independent local radio. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. If you give at least $60, you'll bag our new KAXE eco-friendly notebook. We continue now with Morning Edition on KAXE.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. An Ohio man and his sons took their love for a sci-fi franchise, Stargate, to a new level. They built a 50,000-pound concrete replica of the interplanetary portal on their property. Phil Ventura used a swimming pool as a mold, and he finished the replica about 15 years ago, but social media just noticed, and you know the rest, except Ventura says, no visitors, please. He just built it for his sons. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Every year, world leaders gather together for a summit on global warming. This year, leaders are in Baku, Azerbaijan. Joining me now is Julia Simon, NPR's climate solutions correspondent, to talk about what the stakes are at this year's negotiations. Hi, Julia.
Good morning, Leila.
Okay, Julia, so the meeting kicked off today, less than a week after voters pick Donald Trump as the next president of the United States. To start us off, how does the outcome of the U.S. election shape these talks?
Trump has called climate change a hoax. He's called President Biden's plans to reduce emissions a green new scam. And then there's the Paris Agreement. That's this historic decision to try to limit the world's warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius over temperatures from the late 1800s. Trump pulled the U.S. out of that agreement in his first term. Climate policy experts think he's likely to do it again. Here's Alden Meyer from the climate change think tank E3G.
President-elect Trump has made very clear that he won't wait 6 months to pull out of the Paris Agreement like he did in his last term. He will pull out on day one.
Okay, so what does that mean for these talks then?
So if the U.S. does pull out of the Paris Agreement, which is very likely, it will take some time to make that official. But over the next 2 weeks, it's fairly likely that countries just won't be looking to the U.S. in the same way they would have if Vice President Kamala Harris had won. Countries will likely be looking to China, to the European Union, the United Kingdom, to pick up the slack and say, yes, we still intend to go ahead with the Paris Agreement. This is all really important because by February, countries have to submit these key targets as part of the Paris Agreement. Basically, they have to say, we're going to cut all this climate pollution to meet that goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees.
Do we know if these upcoming targets to cut emissions will be enough to meet this goal?
As of now, a lot of projections say that they won't. At the climate summit last year, participants agreed for the first time that the world needs to transition away from fossil fuels like oil, coal, gas. But many countries, including the U.S., are investing in more and more fossil fuels. Trump has promised he's going to boost them even more. Trump has also promised to make cuts to these climate solutions that are reducing emissions, things like solar, wind, big batteries. These new targets for countries for cutting emissions are supposed to be more ambitious than the last one. So, Leila, this is a big topic of conversation at the summit.
So, Julie, the focus of the climate summit this year is money. What exactly are we talking about money-wise?
As we know, global warming, it's already happening. 2024 is on track to be the hottest year on record. More floods, heat waves, wildfires. It's very expensive to prepare for these climate disasters, particularly for developing countries who contributed the least to climate change. So 15 years ago, wealthy countries said, we're going to give $100 billion annually to developing countries to help them adapt to climate change, to help them transition away from fossil fuels. Pretty much everybody recognizes that $100 billion isn't enough. For context, Colombia recently announced their climate investment plan. They are looking for $40 billion, and they
are just for Colombia.
One country, right. Yeah. Figuring out that number, that's the key goal of the summit. And developing countries also want to be sure that wealthy countries actually know how they're going to pay for it.
That's NPR's Julia Simon. Thank you, Julia.
Thank you, Layla.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. You might know Patrick Dempsey from the 11 seasons he spent playing a neurosurgeon named Derek Shepherd, better known as McDreamy, on Grey's Anatomy.
All right, everybody. It's a beautiful night to save lives.
But it's something he says his mother did not love watching.
She never liked the show. That was
quite funny. She
didn't? No, she did not like that at all.
Oh, wow.
It was too gory for her.
But the fame he gained from that show is what helps his advocacy now.
I think sort of that projection really helped me establish the center. It was one of the best things that came out of that show for me.
The center he's talking about is the Dempsey Center, a cancer care facility he established in 2008 while his mother was in the throes of a years-long battle with ovarian cancer. Amanda Dempsey died in 2014, but Patrick Dempsey says her experience and the memory of what she went through inspires his philanthropy. Most recently, through the Beat the Odds initiative. It's a partnership with the American Cancer Society that focuses on care for not just the patient, but also their families. What was something about her care that you just wish had been different?
Well, I wish we had had a better understanding of what the resources were that were available. Thank God my sister, who was the primary caregiver because she worked in the hospital, so she knew how to navigate what the nurses were doing, what the doctors were doing, and she could be there. And I felt helpless, and I wanted to be able to do something too. It's a devastating piece of news to the family. And it's also something that you don't really think about how hard it is for the caregivers. And all of these things with what we do with wraparound care, we're not treating the disease, we're treating the person.
Yeah.
And everyone who's been impacted.
I was just talking to a friend the other day whose mom is dealing with an advanced melanoma. And the fact that nobody really tells you anything. And there's so, like you said, there's so much waiting and no real advocacy unless somebody's really on top of it.
Right. And it's overwhelming. And sometimes you go into a state of shock and denial, right?
Yeah.
And if you're getting a cancer diagnosis, I recommend that you bring someone with you to take notes, or you bring a tape recorder so that you can record everything. And also make a list of everything that you want to ask them before you go in, because there's so much emotion that it sometimes paralyzes you.
You're from, or you grew up in a more rural area outside of Lewiston, right?
Yeah, I grew up in a little town called Turner, Maine, and Buckfield, Maine. And we were probably about an hour away from the local hospital.
Right.
When I grew up in Turner, we actually had a doctor who would come visit you with a bag and was sort of, he'd come to your house. If you had a cold, you'd call him up. You can do that now, but it's such a huge cost to have that type of private care that rural communities are really isolated and they don't sometimes have all the information that they need. So it's like, how do we get awareness to that?
How? I mean, because we've done a lot of work on just the difficulties in rural areas of accessing, like you said, the cost of driving an hour to get to a hospital or getting to your appointments.
Well, here's a great part of the program is the road to recovery, right? So all you have to do is go to the website, cancer.org, change the odds. In the road to recovery, you sort of type in your zip code and you'll get someone to come and pick you up and get you to your treatment.
Cancer can be a hard thing to talk about. I mean, my mom had breast cancer, very good prognosis. She's fine. But I remember when she said the word, you kind of in your mind associate worst case scenario no matter what. Why do you think it is so difficult to talk about cancer?
The numbers are staggering. You see, one in three women in their lifetime will get a diagnosis. One in two men will get a diagnosis. But if it's detected early enough, the chance of surviving is that much greater. And it's just really building awareness and just take the stigma off of it of not whispering it. I remember doing the play Brighton Beach Memoirs, and there was a big thing in the line was they would always whisper cancer. And I think the more openly we can talk about it, the better off we're going to be.
Millions of people will be listening to this. If you had one piece of advice, just one simple thing that any person should be doing in their life to prevent or check if they have cancer.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is, you know, exercise, have a great conversation with your doctor, get your physicals, make sure you get your screenings, understand your family history. That makes such a huge difference. And, you know, it's very scary. There's a lot of challenges and mental barriers. I even find it for myself. Like I had my screening this week and it was hard. It was hard to go to sleep because I was scared.
Yeah.
But once I got through that, I felt much better and the results came back and I was all fine and clear. It's like if you do these simple things, you're going to be okay. And then if not, then there's the support out there for you. You're not alone. And that's the most important thing.
Patrick Dempsey, advocate, actor, racer. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
A TikTok video offers a glimpse of President Biden's job as seen from the president's point of view. So many people take pictures of any president, but these were taken by Joe Biden himself.
Hey, Mr. President.
Yeah.
If I give you this camera, can you take some photos? We'll get it back and make a video with it?
Sure. Happy to do that.
Thank you so much.
We are America, second to none, and we own the finish line.
Grant Weinstrob is one of the creators of the TikTok account LifeOnFilm.27, which puts disposable film cameras into the hands of random strangers and the man in the world's most powerful job.
There is like nothing really controversial or political about it. It's just like an amazing thing and a level of like access that you don't really ever get.
The photos click by very quickly over about half a minute. You get views from the presidential limo, shots of smiling White House staff, and a photo as Biden sees the Oval Office looking at a stack of bills on the Resolute desk.
I'm kind of like a little bit of a political nerd. So the fact that we were able to include that is just wild to me.
Weintraub says it's hopeful.
Being able to have created something with the president, that's like honor of a lifetime for all of us.
And inspirational.
It is like very American. It sets your mind to it. You can end up making a video with the president.
So, Layla, I'm thinking the next step for this would be for me to hand you a camera to take a picture of life at 4:42 a.m. Eastern time or whenever it is. Does that sound good to you?
Yeah, it's a little bit lonely at 4:45 a.m., but we'll take pictures.
That's true, but we're talking usually at that time, ready for Morning Edition.
Us too.
Yeah, could take a picture of me. Anyway, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Layla Fadel.
It's a minute before 9 o'clock. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Find more information at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. We receive support from Minnesota Power, an elite company, meeting the challenge of climate change head-on while powering the region's homes, businesses, and industries with safe, reliable energy. mnpower.com/energyforward. Remember, you can still bid on items in KAXE's Board of Directors online auction now until 8 o'clock tonight. Find a link at kaxe.org. You can bid on baskets, books, experiences, music, much more. Again, find a link at kaxe.org.